Welcome to the podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. Our podcast weaves together the message and a taste of the music that we experience each Sunday morning as we root our lives in grace through worship here at The Table. More and more people are finding their way to The Table through this podcast, so if you are one of the many, many folks who tune in each week from other parts of California, other parts of our country, or even from other places in the world, we would invite you to take a next step in growing in faith here at The Table. You can do that online at our website, thetableumc.org. There you'll find links to social media and also a way to make a deep commitment to our community to express how you hope to root your life in grace, to grow in faith, to reach in love, and to give generously. If you're one of the many people listening to this but haven't quite walked through the door of the sanctuary yet on a Sunday morning, we would love to welcome you into the beauty of this sanctuary. We gather each Sunday for worship at 9:30 and at 11. Our address is 5265 H Street in East Sacramento.
Will we ever rise? Will we ever rise above the fear? Can we learn to see the need? Can we share humanity? I can see another day come. Broken people, we can be made whole. We can be made whole. We can be made whole as we lay down our weapons, open up our hearts. Love is breaking us, love remaking us.
Our scripture this morning is from John 14. I'll be reading verses 15 to 21. This is Jesus speaking. If you love me, you will keep my commandments, and I will ask the Father, and he will give you another advocate to be with you forever. This is the Spirit of truth, whom the world cannot receive because it neither sees him nor knows him. You know him because he abides with you and he will be in you. I will not leave you orphaned. I am coming to you. In a little while, the world will no longer see me, but you will see me. Because I live, you also will live. On that day, you will know that I am in my Father, and you in me, and I in you. They who have my commandments and keep them are those who love me. And those who love me will be loved by my Father, and I will love them and reveal myself to them.
We lift our eyes up to the hills. When will our help come? Lord, we cry, how long? We lift our eyes up to the hills. Even as we run, hope is chasing us. This is the gravity of love. Just as the moon follows the sun, you're all around me. You're holding everything. This is the hope of every land. Just as the universe expands, your love is reaching. You're holding everything.
Worship last Sunday was rooted in the first few verses of this chapter that Linda just shared, chapter 14 in the Gospel of John. And Linda held her own story, witnessing what it looks like or might look like to rumble with the tendencies that we have in our own everyday lives to allow the initial emotions that we experience when we fall down or disappoint ourselves, find ourselves face down in the arena. We might allow those initial emotions to shape our sense of the world and our sense of who we are and our own worth. And so for Linda, capturing the uncensored truthiness of her own story means bravely facing some feelings of shame and often an unconscious sense that she might be found or exposed as an imposter in her own life, not wise enough or smart enough. So in order to rise strong from that face-down moment in the arena, Linda has to find the courage to walk into those emotions and to rumble with the competing stories that are going on inside of herself about hurt and anger and frustration. She has to move beyond the confabulations, is how Brené Brown talks about them. The stories that we tell ourselves that can become true, though they're false. Stories as we fall down that we make up about ourselves. And if we don't rumble with them, they define us and confine us. And so in order to process this and to rumble with our own stories in this journey toward rising strong, we're invited to do something that Anne Lamott calls us, the G version is stormy first draft. And what happens is when we find ourselves in the midst of one of those experiences of disappointment or failure, of falling down, the idea is that we take a moment in immediately after to kind of write down some quick notes to ourselves so we can capture some of the stories that we're telling. So what are we making up in this moment about our emotions, about our body, about our thinking, our beliefs, our actions? And so what happens, you're face down and we're paying attention to these things and we jot down some notes and then we hold those in conversation with what Brené Brown identifies as these three rumbling questions. So what more do I need to learn and understand about the situation? See, when we don't get curious about our emotions, we allow that first draft to just become our truth, and then it confines us, and we don't really enter into the depths of our own journey or God's movement in our lives. What more do I need to learn and understand about the other people in the story? And what more do I need to learn and understand about myself? So the difference between that first story that we tell ourselves and the truth of where God is meeting us in that story is this image that she says is a delta. That's the difference between what we initially tell ourselves and the wisdom that we find. And it's in between there that we find our key learnings. And so rising strong is something that we do over and over and over throughout our lives, keep revisiting our own story to see what are the learnings that we can rise ever stronger in and through God's hope and love in our lives. So this morning's reading, we pick up where last week left off. And that feels all too true to me. Rumbling is not something that happens in one worship service or even a worship series. It's something that takes years, most often, for us to work on and to work through. So we find ourselves picking up this morning in the middle of that rumbling process and continuing on with the chapter 14 in the Gospel of John. Brené Brown knows how long this takes. She shares a story about her own experience in which she's having a conversation with a friend, and she had been and drifted away from Christian community for quite some time. She had decided that she was going to go it alone, and she liked the idea of being spiritual but not religious, and it was pretty good for her. And then through a conversation with a friend, she was challenged to try back on Christian community. So she found herself going into this Episcopal church, and a priest that evening was sharing about homelessness. And after hearing the priest challenge listeners not to turn away from homeless people, Brené felt a phenomenal sense of shame. And in that shame, the rising strong process started to begin for her. It would actually take her years to rumble with this story, to find her way from that initial face-down moment in that Episcopal church of feeling the depths of the shame in her own life toward finding a wholehearted way of living amidst the complexities of her own privilege. And then ultimately, it meant facing the deeper fears that she needed to look at regarding her own self-worth, her own capacity to be a helper of others. Because for Brené, that part was pretty easy. But what she really needed to look at was the prospect of asking someone else for help. That was the challenge that was underneath years of work for her that she was really trying to run away from when she saw that homeless person. It was really the challenge of, what if I need help in the same way? That's a scarier thing for her and for, for me. And Linda talked last week about finding the brush marks of God by holding her own story in conversation with John 14 and Brené Brown's reflections on feeling shame and fear about being an imposter. And I'm not going to surprise very many of you when I say Linda's story is not mine. And last week was kind of amazing. This happens sometimes in worship, but last week after worship, there were folks who just felt this profound sense of connection with what Linda had shared in her story. And then there were others in the room who were like, no idea what just happened. And that might happen again today, because the truth is my story is not your story, and we're sharing these not for you to understand ours so much as for us to all work on our own journeys together, okay? So, I don't have a lot of fear of walking into a room and being found that I'm an imposter. And I recognize all of the ways that we perform in this very moment, like the gendered norms that we move and have, and sexuality and race and all these things. Like, we live these out, and I wish that we interrupted them more, but I want to acknowledge that that's where we are, and it's who we are. So instead of feeling that sense or fear of being an imposter, what most often happens for me is a fear of actually needing help in a moment. And that's actually rooted in something that's deeper, and when I take time to really look at it, it's a fear of being found out that I'm not good enough. And it takes me a lot of work to get through the mess to figure out that's what's actually going on when I have all of this armor on in a space. My wounds and hurts drive me toward a perfectionism, at least in my own mind, that easily becomes really isolating and harmful. And ultimately, it bends toward a self-righteousness. And as I say that, I recognize that is not most people's image of a pastor. So I want to at least recognize it's not my image of a pastor. And so I have to work on that. That's my life, or at least part of a life journey for me. So it's pretty amazing. It's even grace-filled to me that the readings that were assigned by the global church last week for the church invited us to see the brush strokes of God in our everyday lives. And we assign Linda to lean into that text by facing the ways that she often minimizes the truth that she's beloved and worthy and smart enough and good enough. And this week, the readings that are assigned to the global church have me standing here in front of you at this moment, reflecting on a moment when the disciples find themselves with troubled hearts hearing from Jesus that they don't have to go it alone. They don't have to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. The Comforter will come and be present with them always. Jesus is sending a spirit, a helper, who will literally come alongside them. Jesus tells the disciples that they won't just be sent to be helpers of others, but the Holy Spirit will be with them and will guide and help and comfort and advocate for them. That's the brushstroke of God for me. And it might sound simple or maybe even obvious to some of you in the room, but embracing the truth from Jesus that God doesn't desire for us to go it alone or pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, but instead God sends us a helper to come alongside, that might just be the most life-affirming gospel in a nutshell that I ever get to hear. Brené Brown tells a story about an encounter with a woman who was going to speak with her at this big fancy conference, and Brené had built up a lot of resentment before getting to the conference. Maybe you've had an experience like this. She sets aside about a third of her speaking engagements to do pro bono. And oftentimes she finds in the midst of that, these are the folks that tend to take advantage of her more than anyone else. They have higher expectations, and they express hospitality in more limited ways, and it can feel a struggle. Right? So she found herself feeling underappreciated by the organizers of the event. And instead of naming her own needs and boundaries, she simply went along with them and packed down her growing sense of anger and resentment. And upon meeting this caricature that was going to be her roommate, because part of what happened was she couldn't find it within herself to say, I need my own room if I'm going to be there for 3 days and speak to people. That brought up all kinds of shame for her about her own needs and not being able to care for others. So she couldn't name that. So instead, she stewed in her own self-righteousness, she says. She writes, after years of rumbling with this feeling, I had learned that no matter how right I think I am, or how wrong someone else appears to be, self-righteousness is an off-limits emotion for me. Self-righteousness starts with the belief that I'm better than other people, and it always ends with me being my very worst self and thinking I'm not good enough. Brené took this to her therapist, this struggle that she was having, and she began to rumble en route to her own experience of rising strong. Brené, and for me, up until this very week, to be honest, or this very moment, I'm still working on this, she held this deep-seated sense that people around her aren't really doing the best that they can. She knew that she wasn't supposed to say this, especially not out loud as a social worker. This is not the feeling you're supposed to have, but it's how she felt. And so she shares it with her therapist. She says, look, this wholehearted living, spiritual awakening thing, it's great. I'm fine with it. I like it even, except for the sewer rats and the scofflaws. Those people are BS. A sewer rat doesn't care about the rules and doesn't respect other people's stuff. And a scofflaw is also someone who doesn't follow the rules, but they make fun of people who respect the rules, people like me. They scoff at the law. They mock people, those rule followers. So I've been living in this question this week, and I want to invite you to just hold it with me. Like, do you really believe in your heart that the folks around you are doing the best they can? Brené held this question and did the process that we're inviting you into. She started to write her own stormy first draft. And it came up with a lot of sewer rats and scofflaws, all the people that weren't. And so she divided the world into two categories of people. Two types, those who try our very best. Turns out she found herself in that one. Those who try our very best and follow the rules and are respectful. And the sewer rats and the scofflaws of the world who don't try their best and then they take advantage of people. And so Brené started to test this out with her friends, and she's a professor. She teaches, she does research. So she started to do a number of different studies to try to figure out, like, what's really going on in this? And she was shocked with what she found. She writes about it like this. My formal research continues to bear out the patterns I observed when I informally asked people whether they believe others are doing the best they can. I've now asked hundreds of people the question and documented and coded their responses. I've done the exercise that I did with deacons. She's done this at 20 huge conferences with leaders from various churches. She said, folks, write down the name of someone, and I invite you to think of that person in your own life. Write down the name of someone who fills you with frustration, disappointment, and resentment. Everybody got a person? Or 12? Okay. She says, then, the responses are wide-ranging as she does this, but then she invites them to wonder, what would happen if I believe this person was doing the best that they could? What if this person is doing the best that they can? And the responses range all over the place. One person says, crap. If he's really doing the best he can, then I am a total jerk. I need to stop harassing him and start helping him. One woman says, if this was true and my mother was doing the best that she can, I would be grief-stricken. I'd rather be angry than sad. So it's easier to believe that she's letting me down on purpose than to grieve the fact that my mother is never going to be who I need her to be. What if the person who fills us with disappointment and frustration and resentment is doing the best they can? For me, ugh. If rumbling with these stories, or in rumbling with these stories, Brené found herself returning to a question that was posed to her when she was a graduate student by a professor whose name is Jean Ladding. Whenever someone would bring up conflict with a colleague, this professor would ask, "What is the hypothesis of generosity? What is the hypothesis of generosity? What is the most generous assumption you can make about this person's intentions, about what they said?" And Brené, she said what I would have said. She says, "Based on how I was raised in my relationship with vulnerability, I never thought all that highly of this idea. I always thought it was like asking, what's the best way to get sucker punched in any given situation?" But now, she writes, "as I started working from this new intention that people are doing their best, I remembered this professor's question and started applying it in my own life. So if someone is sending me this curt email, I would try to generously hypothesize that probably they're having a terrible day. Maybe they're not a great email communicator. Maybe their tone doesn't really come through in this. Whatever the case, it wasn't about me." That's what it looks like to read something from a place of generosity. Jesus seems to get this. When Jesus is saying goodbye to his followers, he says, "Very truly I tell you, the one who believes in me will also do the works that I do, and in fact, will do greater works than these." That is huge to me. That is a huge, generous assumption that Jesus is making. The one in whom we're invited to see the full expression of God's love and beauty and possibility looks on at this ragtag group of followers who have seemingly screwed up everything that they've done and generously sees the best in them. So much so, he says that as you set your heart on me and on loving your neighbor, then you're going to do even greater things than I'm doing. That's not just huge, like that changes everything to me. Jesus seems to operate from a hypothesis of generosity and trust that those closest to him are doing the best that they can to find their way. And so our reading this morning from John 14 opens with Jesus trying to make something plain to his followers. All he wants is for them to embrace the love that he has lived among them and make that their goal in life. Live love. Live love, and I trust that you're going to do that even better than I have. He wants them to know, as he says goodbye, that the God that he's known intimately as Abba, the Greek word, or in the Greek translation, it comes to us as Abba, and it usually says Father. A better translation is like Daddy. It's this intimate way that Jesus relates to God. So he says that he's known Abba intimately, and that Abba will continue to accompany you all as an advocate or a helper. The Greek word is actually paraclete. Paraclete. And our translations mostly say that the Holy Spirit is coming to be in, a paraclete is coming to be in the disciples. But the Greek is actually plural, so it's among the disciples. It's not this sense in this moment of like our individual worthiness, but it's God is sending helpers to be among us, to accompany us in loving God and loving our neighbors. So at the very same time that the disciples' hearts are troubled, they hear that the Comforter will come and be present with them always. Jesus is sending another paraclete, a helper to accompany us in loving God and one another. So what I think of is the relationship for children with special needs and a classroom. And so the paraclete is coming. God is not sending a teacher to come and to instruct us in what to do. God is not sending an administrator to come and organize the systems around us. No superintendent is coming. God's not sending like another student to come alongside us. God is sending a paraprofessional who's going to accompany us as we try to discern what it means to love God and love one another in our own lives toward fully participating in a class. That's what the para does, comes alongside and helps you be in it as yourself, as fully present as you can. So I learned as the oldest child in a nurturing family what it meant to be a paraclete. And it's actually one of the ways that I found as a child my own self-worth and my own worthiness and meaning was in trying to help others. I witnessed this in countless ways in my parents, but one that's always stayed with me is every summer, my mom was a teacher, is a teacher now for children with special needs, and in the summer she would host through the University of Kansas a camp for children with autism. And so for parents of children with autism, this was like a week of rest from all of the work they had, their life was, they are the paraclete for that child. And so we would get in the car, in the minivan, me and my brother and my dad, and we would get down to this place, and it was blazing hot in July in Kansas, and each of us would get assigned to a young person who lived with autism on various places on the spectrum. And our job was to accompany them, to just be present with them during that week, 24/7. I have so many great stories about that I'm not going to tell you right now. But what I found in that moment was how easy it was for me to look at this child with autism. Jared was one summer who I was connected with. It was really easy for me to see in Jared's echolalia and all the ways that he moved in the world that Jared's doing the best he can. It just was easy to see it. What was harder for me to see was that, am I doing the best that I can? I tend to believe that I can always do better. And so I hear John 14:15, it says, if you love me, you'll keep my commandments. And I assume it's this like phenomenally conditional statement. It's God's desire that I love God, and I better not let God down. It's this powerful driver of me, to be honest. And it often leads to what the world sees as success. Like, you've stayed up so hard learning to be the best OBGYN. Like, you've stayed up longer than anyone else, worked harder today than anyone else. The world, like, values that kind of drive that sometimes is rooted in running away from something. And it's not where Jesus is going at all in this. See, it turns out that Jesus continues. It doesn't just stop there. Jesus says, I will ask Abba, and he will give you another paraclete to be with you forever. I will not leave you orphaned. I am coming to you. What if Jesus isn't throwing down a gauntlet to say, are you good enough? But instead, Jesus is saying, I'm sending a helper to accompany you, and I'll never leave you orphaned. I could have used those words a few years back when we were dreaming about this, about the table. About 8 years ago, the table was an idea on paper. We had written pages and pages of a ministry plan of how this would take shape, and one of the things that it started with were called the table, so this makes sense. We decided we were going to invite people to join us in the social hall for a potluck, and we wanted you to bring like Northern California style potluck, right? Where bring something from your garden or from the farmer's market, and we'll have this beautiful organic vegan meal in the social hall. It's going to be fabulous. We had the dim lights. We had set this really beautiful lighting around it, and we had candles. The teachers here will appreciate this. We had like paper up on the wall so that we could have markers and we could all have contemplative prayer and enter into the depths of God's silence and hope in our lives. And we were going to write our dreams about what God needed in this place for a church that would be alive and help people love God and love their neighbors. And it was going to be awesome. And like 12 people showed up, and that wasn't great, but it was 12. Like, Jesus did pretty good with 12. So like, it's a starting place. So we're in the right direction. And then those 12 people brought 105 toddlers with them. And like, in, we really did have the children outnumbered, but it didn't feel that way. And the parents and teachers in the room know what that feels like. Instead of like writing things up, the children were pulling the paper off the ground, and the candles made me think the whole place is going to go up in flames. And I just walked out the door, and I do this when I get super, I sweat a lot anyways, but I'm sweating profusely, and I'm holding like this because what's happening to my body is like I'm getting super tight, and I'm angry, and I'm frustrated. And I don't quite know what to do with it. And that's what's happened in my body. And my emotions start to like shut down.
Might be happening.
And then it
right
might be
now.
Happening right now as I re-enter back into it. And in my head, I have all of these lists and stories that I start to write. Like, how did we not know that there were going to be kids here? How did you not know that there were going to be kids here? And have all of these frustrations that start to come out. Like, why did we not plan this out? What happened? What made us think it was a good idea to have candles next to paper, next to three-year-olds? Like, this is not a good idea. And then underneath it, as I start to really get into it, the truth is this question of, like, I don't know how to start a church. Like, for real, I don't know how to do this. We went and got trained by some old white dudes in Dallas who started a church in Atlanta in the 80s and in the suburbs at a country club. Like, they don't get it, and so I'm writing that down. Why didn't they teach us to do this? I've got all of those things. And then I have another friend in Kansas City who started a church at the same time. He would tell stories where he would go to a coffee shop and he would say, you know, I was there for a few hours. I met like 35 people and I got to hear some of their faith journey and I got to invite them to like rethink church. It was phenomenal. I could sit at Tupelo for like 4 hours and meet no one, meet not a single person. And then I could walk down, Chocolate Fish wasn't there. I could walk down to Old Soul and sit there for the afternoon and also meet no one. And then when I really did start to meet people, like the image that I had of what our conversation was going to be like, it wasn't like that. It was just awkward. And I thought, well, they're never going to come to the table. And so then I would hole up. I would find my laptop and I would close the door and I'd say, well, we're at least going to have an awesome website. And I would work on that to get away from it because I couldn't really face the fear or the failure or my own perfectionism, all of those things that are like swirling around. And how different would it have been if instead of having that to-do list, which was super long, like that's what I'm creating, like a whole list of things I need to do better next time. And in between each line of the thing I need to do better tends to be like more resentment that I push down, at least for a short time until it blows up on the people that I try to love the most. Brene Brown says that instead of that to-do list, what we should all really write, and it should be on a real small piece of paper in our pocket, who are the two or three or four people that are never going to let you go and that you want to hold your life in relationship to? Because ultimately, all these resentments can start to fade away when you look at that list and you think, these people still love me and I still want to love them. And that's what really matters. The difference between the confabulations, like my first draft of all the things that are wrong, and it's a dark, wide, and stormy distance to get to like what's really going on with my own fears about being good enough and about needing help and not really being alone. It's a long journey. As I sit in that, this week, with Jesus' promise that God's going to send a paraclete, a helper, these are some of the things that I've been learning about myself, and I want to share a few of them with you. The first is just this notion that we're all doing the best that we can. The sewer rats and the scofflaws lens is a dangerous one for me. It's a dangerous way for me to think about the world. Because the truth is, as soon as I start to go that route, it doesn't take me very long to get to seeing that I'm a little rodent with my own jacket on. That's the other side of it. So in order to stay out of resentment, I need to maintain better boundaries. And that's actually harder for me. Like Brene, saying what I need and claiming that rather than assuming that everybody around me can read what is going on in my head. Blaming others less and holding myself then more accountable in asking for what I need. Then it becomes about me rather than about that person. And ultimately, with Brene Brown, this rumbling taught me why self-righteousness is so dangerous. And she writes about it this way. Most of us buy into the myth that it's a long fall from I'm better than you to I'm not good enough. But the truth is, these are the two sides of the same coin. Both are attacks on our own worthiness. We don't compare when we're feeling good about ourselves. When we practice self-compassion, we're compassionate toward others. Self-righteousness is just the armor, she says, of self-loathing. And then she shares these words. In a culture of scarcity and perfectionism, asking for help can be shaming if we're not raised to understand how seeking help is human and foundational to connection. We can encourage our children, we can't encourage them to ask for help if they don't see us embodying that in our own lives, in our own ways of being. The bottom line is that we simply need each other. Jesus knew this when he said farewell to the folks that he knew he was saying goodbye to, and then saw in them this generous possibility of all that they would become. We need each other not just in this like civilized, proper, convenient way. We need each other in the depths of face down in the arena. I can't do this by myself. God is sending a paraclete, and that might be you. Brené Brown believes that we can find our way to wholehearted living by holding generous assumptions about others and allowing ourselves to ask for help as we do something that she calls living big, boundaries, integrity, and generosity. So I want to invite myself and some of you to listen in. What boundaries do I need to put in place so I can work from a place of integrity and extend the most generous interpretations and intentions and words and actions of others around me? Setting boundaries means getting clear on what behaviors are okay for me and what aren't. Integrity is key to the commitment because it's how we set those boundaries and ultimately hold ourselves and others accountable to respecting them. Integrity is choosing courage over comfort, choosing what is right over what's fun or easy or fast, and choosing to practice our values rather than simply profess them. And then she closes, living big is saying yes. I'm going to be generous in my assumptions and intentions while standing solidly in my integrity and being very clear about what's acceptable and what's not. Jesus says to us, if you love me, you'll keep my commandments, and I will ask Abba, and Abba will give you another paraclete to be with you forever. I will not leave you orphaned. I'm coming to you. So what if part of rising strong here at the table is about embracing this deep truth, that we're in this together, and that God won't orphan us? We need one another. Yes, God may need me to come alongside you as a paraclete, and God most certainly needs you to come alongside me as one. Generous accompaniment. This is the promise that Jesus makes to his followers as he says goodbye. God is sending a generous companion, loving paraprofessional, to walk alongside us and to help us find our way into abundant life together in the midst of the vulnerability that it requires. See, Jesus, and I don't want us to lose track of this, Jesus made this promise after Judas had already departed into the night and after Peter had been exposed that he was going to betray Jesus 3 times. This was not a perfect group of people that Jesus was looking on seeing, but it was the people right in front of him. And what Jesus chose to read generously was God's love moving in their lives, and then to wonder about how that might rise. And Jesus says, I'm sending you another paraclete. So friends, for whom in your life will you be that this week for? What will it mean for you to come alongside someone who is somewhere in the midst of rising strong and to be for them a paraclete, a helper, an advocate, a comforter? And just as importantly, who are those paracletes in your life? Who are those people who come alongside you as you find yourself face down in the arena or somewhere along the way of rising strong? One of my professors and mentors in seminary is Emily Towns. And Dr. Towns says this. He says, keep integrated. Resist pulling apart. Have friends tell you when they see pieces of you drifting away. So who are those friends who will stay with you and help you to know when you're drifting from the wholehearted life that Jesus promises you? Jesus says, I'm sending you another paraclete. So may we rise strong in and through that promise, now and always. Amen.
Weird one, and yes, wise one, standing on rocks of compromised cliffs, trying to find your thrill, peace against your will. That's the way you want to live. Big one, and yes, small one, flying through smoke and lying on the mud, trying to find your thrill, peace against your will. That's the way you want to live. Well, I need someone just to be there, just to be square for me. I've been through it all. Catch me when I fall. Just be there for me.